Good evening. Welcome to our weekly free self coaching call. This is Dr. Ron Janus, and substituting for Bradley Winship. And this evening, we're going to have our weekly friends and family coaching call. Again, there's nothing that's going to be sold, nothing to sign up for. This is just a free service providing you with information that can help you in your life. Again, it's about coaching. Coaching is different from a doctor who may do things for you, like a brain surgeon or an auto mechanic who does things for you. Coaching is actually different than teaching, where a parent or a teacher or even a doctor might explain to you and tell you what to do and tell you what to do and then teach you how to do it. Coaching is a little different. Coaching is about empowering you to make good decisions for yourself, helping you get clarity so you can make good decisions, and then helping you motivate yourself so that you will follow through on those decisions. So it's kind of like if you in athletic coaching, at the younger levels, there are obviously the coach is also a teacher, maybe even a babysitter. But as you progress and get into high school and then college and possibly professional athletes, they still have coaches all the way through. But as the athletes progress, the coach does less teaching and more helping the athlete to decide what they want to do and motivate themselves so that they can perform at their very best. And that's what coaching is really about, and that's what these calls are about. We're not trying to tell you what to do, not necessarily teaching you, although hopefully we can provide information that's useful to you. Our primary goal is to help you get clarity about what you choose to have in your life and helping you to find the inner motivation to follow through on those decisions. So the first thing we usually ask when we're working with coaching is, what do you want? What do you choose for your life? And sometimes we know, sometimes we're not too sure. So it never hurts. In fact, it helps a lot to write things down. And so you might just want to start with a list. And don't be too hard on yourself or discriminatory, but just start writing. What would I change? What kind of change would I choose for my life? And if I could change anything at all, what would it be? And just start writing down a list of anything that pops into your head that you think you'd like to have different in your life. And then work with the list. Eventually, you might want to decide to prioritize the list. We've talked about three columns, A, B, C, of things that you really, really want in your life and really choose to work on, things that may be a little less important than that, but still important to you, and then things that if you can get them to change, that's good, but it's not necessarily absolutely vital. This evening, we're going to talk a little bit about the role of habits in our life and in the coaching process, as well as helping to get clarity, to make your own decisions, and decide what you want to do for your life, what you'd like to change, and then motivating yourself to do it. So we probably all have a list of things that we've chosen in the past to change, and that we would like to change. And somehow, even though we give it our best shot, we don't change it. Or we try for a little while, and then we end up doing the same thing we were doing before. Why is that? Well, the number one reason why change is so difficult at times is because of something called habits. We all function from habits. In fact, the more research that's done in neurophysiology, the more people, the researchers, are beginning to understand that most of what humans do, behavioral patterns, metabolic function, but most of the activity we perform, we do out of a habit or a memorized behavioral pattern. Now that's kind of important, and it actually is very, very useful when it works right. Because if we had to stop and think about every nerve and muscle that twitches when we walk, we probably couldn't do it. Talking, for example, is one of the most complex neurological functions we do as humans. And in fact, some researchers are still puzzled at the fact that we can even do it, because so much coordinated nerve activity has to happen in order for us to articulate and speak with emotion and punctuation and meaning And it takes a long time for a child to learn to do that, and yet they do. And they learn it almost automatically. But note that if, as an older person, we decide we want to learn another language, and that's an important change or goal that we'd like to do, it's a lot of work. And especially to get to the point where you can actually communicate in another language without having to stop and think and translate everything. So the one thing about habits is that once they're there, if it's a good habit, it's great, because you don't have to think about it. That's the whole purpose of this whole memorized behavioral patterning, that the nervous system uses. Now, different researchers will give you different estimates. You'll hear 60 to 80% of what we do is by habit. Some say over 90%. Actually, it's related to how much stress you're under. The more stress, the more likely it is that you start to function from habit, because the body's number one priority is to help you survive. And so things that it thinks helps you survive in the past are very likely to be things that it will run automatically when you reach a certain stress level. And especially if we get to the point of fight or flight. That fight or flight pattern we've all heard about is probably genetic. It's probably something they're born with. And as you grow, you can learn to modify fight or flight based on perception. So for example, if you take a small child to the zoo or the circus and they hear a lion roar, they may start crying. And yet they're perfectly safe, but they don't know that. Or if you go take the child to Yellowstone, they actually used to have a lot of problems there because little kids would want to go pet the baby bears. And of course, the baby bear mamas didn't like that very much. But as a small child, they really didn't know the difference. But as you get older, from observing other people and education, you realize that there's a big difference between a bear at the zoo or a lion and one out in the wild that's actually a threat to you. So it is possible to modify fight or flight based on perception, basically to modify what triggers it up to a point. So once that fight or flight mechanism kicks in, there's very specific things the body does to protect you, to save you. If you really were attacked by a grizzly bear or a lion, your body would go into fight or flight, and a lot of things that normally happen in the body stop happening because of that fight or flight program. For example, if you were being chased by the bear, would your body care about eating breakfast? Not really. In fact, it might even throw up breakfast in order to help you run faster. The body wouldn't care if you had a sprained ankle. In fact, it'll produce hormones that cover up pain and allow you to keep running anyway. So tissue repair is not a big priority when you're being chased by a bear. Neither is immunity. If you have a cold, the body could care less. Or let's say you potentially might be dying of cancer in 3 to 5 or 10, even 10 days from now. Your body is going to shut down because of cancer or heart disease. But if you're running from the bear, the body really doesn't care, and it'll totally ignore those things. And that's all appropriate if you get chased by a bear once in a while. And that's all a habit pattern locked into the nervous system. And changing it is really challenging. For example, what experts will say is that if you really are chased by a bear, the best thing you can do is lay down and play dead. But I would imagine that's probably not a habit pattern. Most of us would have to really work to be able to do that. So changing habits that are already there, especially if they involve a lot of stress, can be really difficult. So that's where the real issue comes in. When you go to change something on your list, and even though you know it's something you want to change, even though you may have some internal motivation to do it, but no matter what you do, and most of us have experienced this, for example, with a diet. We might get an idea that this is really going to work, get excited, do it for a few days or a week or two, and then sooner or later we're back eating the way we always have. That's because it's a behavioral pattern, and very often tied to emotional patterns. So understanding how habits work, and which habits serve you and which don't, and what to do when you decide you want to change one, can be really important and helpful when you go through your coaching process. When you decide you want to change things, and you prioritize your list, and you decide this is something I really like to do, and then you try to change it, but in a short period of time you find yourself right back at square one, then probably there's a pre-existing habit pattern that's keeping you from being able to change. And once people establish a pattern that they like, we tend to stay with it even when it doesn't serve us. Why is that? Well, the part of the brain that we're talking with, the cognitive part of the brain where we logic, look at new information, cognition and decide what we want to do with it is actually a pretty small part of the nervous system. Some researchers will say that it's as little as 1/10 billionth of the nervous system. And maybe it's more, maybe it's less. I don't think anybody actually measured it. But it's based on what is the comparative research. They feel that the part of the nervous system that runs the automatic system, the habit patterns for behavior, metabolic activity, your heart beating, the lungs breathing, is probably the vast majority of your nervous system. Now, that part of the nervous system doesn't think. All it does is run patterns. It runs habit patterns. Now, a few of those habit patterns, like maybe that fight or flight or basic breathing, are genetically imprinted. Now, animals, a lot of it is. In fact, some animals do really remarkable things based on instinct, like butterflies that migrate thousands of miles, or big birds, and never were taught how to do that by their parents because they're... for example, in the case of the butterflies, their lifespan doesn't last long enough for that information to be passed along. So it's all genetic. It's in instinct. Humans, however, while we have some instinctive things we do, like breathing, most of our learning is by behavioral training, by behavior modification and learning habits. Why is that? Well, the reason we have a longer childhood than most animals is that this gives the opportunity for parents and community to actually train up a boy in the way he goes, like a verse in the Bible says, and he'll follow it. So it allows community and cultural variation, and it allows parents to have a huge influence over how their family's beliefs and values that their children are going to grow up with. And as Dr. Minshew mentioned in one of our earlier lectures, beliefs are a big part of how we determine values, and those values are a big part of how we decide what's important to us and how we react to things. So most of us don't remember a lot from our first 4 or 5 years of life. There's a reason for that. It's because that non-cognitive part of the nervous system is totally functioning and absorbed in memorizing essential life behavior patterns. Again, learning to walk, learning to talk, learning how to react to people, learning really important things like if I get lost, Mommy and Daddy will come find me. That's what that little child's hide-and-seek game is all about. Or playing peekaboo about a 2-year-old or even younger. That's about learning if your parents are really there even when you can't see them. So there's a lot of repetitive things that we do over and over and over as small children, and we're training those behavior patterns. Now, the thing is, most of those patterns, hopefully, are patterns that are useful to us, and we can use them for the rest of our life, like saying please and thank you, looking both ways before we cross the street, being able to know roughly how to react when people behave a certain way. So, of course, not everyone has a really good childhood. And in a dysfunctional family, an emotionally associated dysfunctional family, people may learn patterns that are not useful for them later on. But even in a really good family, you'll still have some things that you learned as a child that may not serve you as you get older. And as you do get older and you practice different behaviors, you tend to overwrite those old behavior patterns. For example, looking both ways before you cross the street is probably a useful behavior pattern that you'll continue to do for the rest of your life. And not having to think about it, doing it automatically, is a big advantage. But what about the one you can't cross the street unless Mommy holds your hand? Now, would that be a behavior pattern that you'd want to keep for the rest of your life? Probably not. So as you get older, you learn that it's safe to cross the street as you're big enough and your behavior pattern overwrites that other pattern. In some cases, though, we develop patterns that don't overwrite very easily. And there's basically 3 different reasons to determine not only how deeply these patterns are embedded in our nervous system and will persist, and secondly, it gives us some real insight about what it takes to change those patterns. So, for example, if you really were chased by a bear or a lion, that's a pretty intense experience. And so you're going to be really scared, you're going to be running for your life, Let's say you get away from the event, and now you're safe. You're back home, everything's cool, but you have this really stressful event. And one of the things I always ask people when I'm giving a lecture to doctors or patients or lay people is we give them the scenario, and then we'll ask, now if you really were chased by a bear, and then you get home safe, how long do you think it'll take before your nervous system resets yourself, resets your body to where you were before you saw the bear? Okay. Well, what do you think? How long would it take for your body to reset itself after you're chased by a bear? Well, when I ask doctors that question, it's really interesting, because I'll get it. Most of the answers I get are a couple hours, a couple days, maybe a couple weeks. When I ask patients or lay people, then it's usually a little longer, a couple weeks, a couple months. Occasionally, somebody will say, well, that probably took me a long time. So it's true, it does vary from person to person. However, the research indicates, and there's research in neurophysiology, that if you have one highly stressful event in your life, like being chased by a grizzly bear, it will probably take between 2 and 10 years before the body is able to completely reset from that. You see, how long would it be that you, well, you would have, perhaps have nightmares or dreams about bears? How long would it be before you saw a bear or a picture of a bear even and didn't feel a little nervous? That could go on for a long time. So the key question here is, how many two-year periods can you remember in your life when you only had one stressful event on one afternoon in the whole 2 years? Okay, and I kind of hear all the laughing in the background, because most of us have a lot more stressful days in a two-year period than just one. And how many stresses do we have that last longer than one day? The other issue that comes up is that in modern life, we don't really get chased by bears very often. We can have a bear-like experience, maybe an auto accident or get mugged or something like that. But usually the stresses we're facing in modern life are mental, emotional. They have to do with social and financial stresses. Now, most of those don't just happen once and then we're done with it. If we're having relationship issues, that tends to go on for a while. If we're having financial issues, that goes on for a while. And sometimes it can be pretty intense. And when those financial, social, or other mental emotional stresses, like perhaps having someone in the family with a long-term chronic illness or someone who eventually dies after a long illness, that can be pretty intense. And that will last for a long time in the someone's nervous system. Researchers, for example, say that a divorce can take 6 to 9 years for a person to really process if they don't have special training or therapy to help them. And so we're talking about a long time. We're talking about things that pile up on a person. And then it gets even more fun because guess what? The body doesn't judge stress the way you and I do. If I ask you what stresses you out, you probably give me a list of things you usually don't like or that are very upsetting to you. However, your body doesn't see things that way. The body actually determines stress in terms of the theme of tonight's call, change. Anything your body has to change its memorized behavior patterns for is considered really stressful. So, for example, something like getting a new house, getting a new job, moving to a different city, a baby being born in the family, or a death in the family, these are all really stressful events for the body. Even if they might be a happy event, the body has to go through a lot of changes in order to handle it. And if you don't believe that, ask any mother and father with a newborn baby. As happy as they are about the baby, there's a lot of changes going on in their life, and it's very, very stressful. So we have a lot of different factors determining stress. Now, let's say we want to change a pattern that was not useful to us. For example, let's say you got really, really stressed in college, and you were getting ready for an exam, or you had something else you were worried about, and you happened to drink too much, and the stress seemed like it was much better. So what if from that point on, every time you got stressed, you decided to have 2 or 3 or 4 or more drinks? Well, that's how people can become an alcoholic. Now, the body is wiring that behavior pattern, just like it does fight or flight, as a survival pattern. If you do it long enough, and the body perceives it as providing relief in some form, the body begins to wire it the same way it does all the other patterns. However, this pattern is one that doesn't serve you. But if the body is under enough stress, and it perceives that that stress is modified by the behavior, even if it's not a good behavior for it, it gets wired right in there with the fight or flight. And that leads us to an understanding of the three major things that determine how deep in your nervous system these behavioral patterns go, and then it gives us an idea of what we might have to do to start changing them, and what we might work with a coach to help us with any particular pattern. This will explain why it isn't just a matter of saying, okay, I'm never going to smoke again. And sometimes for some people that works, but most people it doesn't. Or I'm never going to eat sugar again. I'm going to be perfectly good on my diet, and yet we don't actually do it. Okay, so here's the three things, if you'd like to write them down, that mostly determine how deep a habit pattern goes into your nervous system and how challenging it might, how easy or challenging it might be to change. Okay. So, the number one, and probably the most important, is the emotional intensity. So, for example, getting chased by a bear has a really high level of emotional intensity. And it only takes one time. One time, and that can be in your nervous system for at least 2 to 10 years, and maybe for the rest of your life. Now, if you have several grizzly bear experiences in a 2-year period, if you have a grizzly bear experience that goes on, it's maybe equivalent of being lost in the woods for a month and chased repeatedly by bears, that is something that may wire at such a deep place that it never changes. And we have a name for that in medicine. It's called post-trauma stress disorder. And it's where a person has had so many of these intense stressful experiences that their body hardwires it in the same place in the brain, the midbrain survival mechanism, where it would wire running from the bear or trying to save itself physically. But this is what causes addiction, by the way. We believe that addiction replaces these survival patterns in the brain. If you're under a lot of stress, a very high level of stress, and you use the substance over a period of time, in some cases it doesn't even have to be a lot of times. In some people it can happen just in a few or even once. But when if emotional intensity is high enough and you get relief from a behavior or a chemical, your body starts to believe that that's how I survive that stress, and it will begin to wire it just like it does the fight or flight. That's why just thinking about it doesn't fix an addiction. You can know yourself that you shouldn't be smoking, shouldn't be over-drinking, shouldn't be using cocaine or heroin. But if the body has decided that that's fight or flight, changing it can be just as hard as trying to lay down there and let the bear come up and sniff you. And the body just does not want to do that. So anyway, number one is emotional intensity. The higher the level of emotional intensity, the deeper the process will go into your nervous system. And if it's not a lot of emotional intensity, say a casual activity, then two other factors come into play. One is the amount of nerve firing or muscle activity that occurs during the event. Now again, with the grizzly bear event, fight or flight, a lot of nerve firing, a lot of muscle activity. So that helps drive it even further into the nervous system, and you only need one time, and you remember it for the rest of your life. The third is repetition. How many times does it happen? And as we already said, with a grizzly bear experience, high emotional intensity, high level of nerve firing in the skeletal muscles, and you're going to end up with something that even one time can be with you for the rest of your life. But another activity, say driving to work, you may have to do that a lot of times before it's there. And if you change jobs, it's for usually about 3 weeks, 3 to 6 weeks at most, of that you're driving to the new job. And at first, you've got to pay attention. You've got to pay attention to where you're going, follow directions, if you're not familiar with where it's at. But after 2 or 3 weeks, you'll find that you're listening to the radio, combing your hair, hopefully not talking on your cell phone, but whatever, and you get there anyway. This, by the way, is one of the best examples that we have of how powerful these behavioral programs are and how extensive they are in the nervous system. Because all of us that drive a car probably have the experience of going somewhere that we're used to going to, so we've memorized the route, maybe even without consciously doing it, just go there enough times, and all of a sudden it's there. But we drive there, and something distracts us, and overthinking about something, and we end up at our destination, and we honestly can't remember driving. Is that amazing or what? But you could actually do something as complicated as driving in traffic, stop for the light, stop for pedestrians, change lanes, do all those things you do when you're driving, and you don't even remember doing it. It gives you some idea of just how powerful these behavioral programs can be, not just in the emotional intensity, but in how thoroughly they alter our nervous system activity and the level of competence we can actually have. In fact, if it wasn't for that level of competence with repetition, a lot of sports activities would be almost impossible to perform. Things like hitting a baseball, especially at the college or pro level, hitting a golf ball, these are activities that are so complex neurologically that if you don't practice them and get to where you can do them essentially without thinking about them, you never get very good at it. And that gives us another key about not only establishing new patterns, but how to change them. So remember the three things: emotional intensity, the amount of nerve firing that occurs during the episode or activity, and finally, how many times you do it. Okay, so those three are the factors. What we call it, algorithm. I just wanted to use that word because I actually studied math in school, and I never get to use any math words, so that's the one I'm throwing in. Algorithm, just basically a formula that'll tell you how deeply a habit pattern's gone in, give you a rough idea, and how much the challenge it'll be to change it. Because the higher the level of emotional intensity associated with the habit, the amount of physical and mental activity that goes along with the habit, and finally, the number of times you've done it is going to have a big effect on how easy it's going to be to change that particular habit. So then I'll get to the point where, okay, we decided we want to change something. But we make a decision. That's great. That's the first step in the process. Get clarity. This is something that I've chosen to change in my life. And we go ahead and give it a shot. And within a few days or a week, we're right back doing the same things again. And it gets frustrating. We've all had that experience. And it can be pretty upsetting to be doing these things and then wondering, what in the world do I have to do to change this? Well, stop and think for a moment. How much emotional stress have I experienced over the years, especially when I started doing this activity? That's going to be a factor. How many times have I done it? That's going to be a factor. And how much mental and physical nerve activity is there during how much is the nervous system affected by the activity? And now you begin to realize that something like maybe smoking can be hard to change because you've done it for a long time. It changes a lot of nerve activity in the body. Remember, the first time people smoke, in almost every case, they get sick. Your body tells you the first time that you, I don't like this. But because of peer pressure or sexy ads on television, whatever it might be, we keep doing it. And as time goes by, the nervous system actually adjusts to where we get to the point where we actually crave it. And we want it all the time. And whenever we're stressed, we want. Because if we've modified stress over the years by smoking, now the body associates that with stress relief and thinks it's a good thing, even though in the long run it really might not be. So how does this affect what's required or what we might choose to do to change a habit? Well, once you get that a general idea of how much emotion was involved, how much nerve activity is involved, and how much repetition is involved, it'll help you understand and be a little bit more reasonable with yourself about what it takes to change an activity. And what it takes to change it is the same three things. There has to be level of emotional activity, a level of nerve activity that goes with that, and a certain amount of repetition. If something that you're changing involves your body, remember, the body doesn't think. The body only maintains what an athlete would call muscle memory. This is a little bit of a misnomer, but nonetheless, we kind of get the concept. If you wanted, as an adult, to learn to play the piano, you hadn't done it before, then just listening to someone tell you how to do it, or watching a movie or a video of someone playing the piano, probably doesn't make you a good piano player. You might pick up a few pointers, but ultimately, you have to practice. And if you practice in a lackadaisical, bored way, versus really enjoying it and enjoying the sound and emotionally getting involved in what you're doing, who do you think learned faster? Well, obviously the person with an emotional involvement, and but they still have to practice, but they won't have to practice as many times to get the same level of competence. Why? Because there's an emotional intensity involved. And so emotional intensity, the amount of mental and nerve activity that's involved, and then repetition will determine how quickly you can learn a new habit. Now, one of the challenges comes in if whatever it is we want to change has to do with our coping mechanisms or stress handling. Because if what we're doing now was imprinted with a high level of emotional intensity, like getting chased by a bear, the odds are that when we go to practice it, we may not have that same level of intensity. So that automatically is telling us that we would have to practice it more in order to change something. Or we'd have to have a really strong emotional commitment to changing it to help get the intensity level up. The process we're talking about is real similar to what we would do, like, or what they do in basic training for soldiers. It's just not natural to let somebody shoot guns at you, or shoot bullets at you, or throw bombs at you, or whatever else they do to try to kill you. So the natural response would be fight or flight, and mostly flight. An untrained person, somebody starts shooting at you, you want to get away. So what do they have to do to take all the recruits and help them so that they can get to the point where they'll follow orders and hopefully even fire their guns under pressure? Well, that's what basic training is all about. And they take a 6 to 9 week period, and they have them practice over and over and over with what? Emotional intensity. They've got a drill sergeant that's being really emotional and emotionally intense about the training. At a certain point in the training, they might even fire live ammunition or something that sounds like live ammunition while they're going through their exercises, again, to get the emotional intensity up and to get them to practice at that level so that it imprints and it'll be there when they really need it. So those are some of the things to take into account when you make a decision to change the behavior pattern in your life. So one of the ways that you can tell if your body is resisting is remember that the body, unlike the mind, has to live in the present. Your mind can go anywhere. You can think about something that's happening tomorrow. You can think about something that happened last week. You can even think about things that are make-believe or imaginary, like going through a movie or reading a novel, and you can get all emotionally involved in it. But the body can only be here and now. You can't raise your right hand at 2 o'clock tomorrow. You can't pat yourself on the head at 3 o'clock yesterday. The body has to be here and now. So when you go to change a habit or to practice a new activity or even think about it, one of the ways you can check is to check how you feel, what your emotion is. The reason for that is that, once again, the body doesn't think the way the brain does. But one of the exciting things that has been discovered in research in neurophysiology in the last 10 to 30 years is that the body remembers things and finds these programs based on how you feel. In other words, if you have a certain emotion while practicing something, or a certain emotion when you are under a stressful event, the body files all emotions of that type, apparently, in a filing system that's all in the same place. So the events are not necessarily stored in the body the way you might store them in your head. In your head, you might remember certain details like the color or the temperature or all kinds of details that will happen. But the body is primarily going to look at the feeling or emotion that you had when the event occurred or when the habit was formed. So if you think about an activity or you go to do an activity, pay particular attention to how you feel while you're doing it. If the feeling does not match your circumstances in this moment, then probably there's an emotional memory pattern running, and what you're reacting to is not what's going on right now. You're reacting to the emotions that you felt in the past, either doing that activity or your body's remembering that activity when you're trying to do something different. So, for example, if you're going to quit smoking, if that's what you've decided you'd like to do, the inner motivation to stop smoking has to be more emotionally intense than the satisfaction or enjoyment that you think you're getting from smoking, and possibly more than the level of stress, or at least different than the stress level or stress intensity that you experience when you use smoking as a way to modify the stress. So these are some of the things that you might want to look at, and when you're thinking about changing the way your body deals with the habit. So if you've been doing something for a long, long time, many of the things we do, in fact, the researchers say probably well over half of what we do in the body are habit patterns that we learned before we were 5 or 6 or 7 years old. Things like walking and talking and basic social interaction are learned before then. So if we learn the wrong thing, or if we are still behaving in that manner, then that means that we're still stuck in those patterns. And the way you would notice that is by what the emotion is. For example, if you went across the street and you get really, really scared as an adult and have a phobia about crossing the street unless someone's holding your hand, then possibly there's a behavior program from childhood that's still running. And that's what you would be working with to change it. And you change things by changing the emotional intensity when you practice. So like in sports, the coaches will create opportunities like practice games or like the firing of blanks during a training exercise in the military that increase emotional intensity. So they'll have contests, they might holler, they might do all sorts of things to motivate you so that practice does not become lackadaisical and boring. Because if there's emotional intensity associated with the activity, then it's far more likely that you're going to learn the new behavior quickly and be able to do it from the end of the activity. So that's the end of our call for tonight. We thank you and hope all of you enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week for our next call.